Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine. Have a lot of good topics. You know, last week we had polls, polls, polls. This week we're going to have a real live pollster to help us make sense of some of these polls. Dr. Beth Shapiro of the Shapiro Group will join us. Also, I'm going to talk about General Henri from Hurricane Katrina and him possibly jumping into politics. The impeachment of Mark Sanford. We're also going to do a little congressional talk in both the 9th and the 4th, and plenty of other things. But let me welcome my co-host. Welcome, Catherine.
Hello, everyone.
And welcome, Tim.
Good evening.
Yes. Well, I guess the first thing, even though we're a Southern political show, Ted Kennedy was much bigger than just Massachusetts. I mean, he was one of the senators that when people saw that body, they would think of. So let's go ahead and kind of talk about the thoughts of, you know, what his life and, you know, the proceedings of the week, if you will, of Ted Kennedy. Catherine, what was your thoughts on that?
Well, I was, I've always been a big admirer of Teddy Kennedy in his sort of the way that he overcame personal and political shortcomings and really lived his life, lived out at least the last couple decades of his life as a real leader for liberals in this country, and also working across the aisle with Republicans. He was very impressive, and all the stories we heard this week, and the incredible outpouring of love and affection for him at the funeral yesterday was really quite moving. And it's sad, but he certainly did carry the torch for his fallen brothers for all these years, and we lost a great leader, and I hope that there are people who have been inspired by his service who will step up and fill his shoes, or at least attempt to.
Oh, yes. Tim, your thoughts?
Well, he surely was echoing what Catherine said. He was one of the last old liberal lines in the Senate. It's the passing of an era, of course, with him being gone. He became a U.S. senator when I was 7 years old. He really did carry the torch for liberals up there in the Senate. And the Senate is really going to miss him. And the American people are going to miss this guy more than they realize. Did you know that this man has over 300 pieces of legislation with his name on it that became law? I would submit, David, that this guy is the greatest senator in the history of the U.S. Senate.
Well, I mean, and I think the 20th century, that might be a very possible statement. I think if you go through the Henry Clays and whatnot, it may there may be some people that kind of
rival. He was once compared to Daniel Webster. Somebody said to him, you know, you and Daniel Webster are the two greatest senators of all time. And Kennedy said, yeah, what did Webster do? You know, so he was.
So he was another, not very humble then, I take it.
No, he was humorous was what he was.
Yeah, he had an incredible sense of humor. I actually had dinner with a friend of mine the other night who spent a lot of time on Cape Cod in her youth. And she said that he was, she remembers him being in the ice cream store and making sure that everyone was happy and had their ice cream. And, you know, he apparently spent a lot of time, they told a lot of stories about him at the funeral yesterday. One of the ones that I found really touching was after the September 11th attacks, he called every family in Massachusetts that had a loss in that in 9/11, and not only did he call them once, but he followed up with them regularly to make sure that they were doing all right and to help them if they were, you know, try to resolve any issues they had surrounding it. And he was really quite a fellow. You know, he was very compassionate and had, you know, a fantastic family. The family was all on there yesterday, and they were really amazing. All the grandchildren and nieces and everybody came up and spoke, and it was very moving. I think he was very fortunate in many ways. You know, he had a very good, solid, long life, and it's going to be a big hole in the Senate for everyone, not just for the Democrats.
Oh yes, and I know that comes on the heels of his sister dying just like, what, 2 weeks ago, Eunice Shriver, that founded the Special Olympics. Well, I know at the top of the program, we can talk more about Senator Kennedy later, we talked about the start of the program having a real-life pollster, and I believe she's on the line. Welcome, Dr. Shapiro.
Oh, well, thank you, David. Your real-life pollster is here.
Yes. Well, just for the folks that aren't familiar, and I know a lot of our listeners will be familiar with your work, tell us a little bit about your firm and your work in the past.
Well, thanks, David. I'm glad to be on here with you. Our firm is the Shapiro Group. We are based in Atlanta. We've been based here for the past 25 years. And we are a strategic consulting firm that works in the areas of marketing and advocacy. And while we don't do many, if any at all, candidate campaigns anymore, we have worked with a lot of candidates over the years, both in Georgia, throughout the Southeast, and a few outside the Southeast as well. And we develop strategy. We conduct polling. We do the research for our clients, and then we develop strategies for them from that research.
Oh yes, and I thought that any more is important. That means you know how to do political polling, how to analyze it, but you just don't have a dog in any current fight, which means you can be unbiased and give analysis.
Which is what makes it so much fun to be on shows like this.
Yes. Well, I mean, there's just been there's been more polls than action so far in our home state of Georgia in the governor's race. And there was another poll out this week. There was a Rasmussen poll out last week and a Strategic Vision poll out this week that showed some varying numbers, particularly on the Democratic side, in the number two slot. And the Rasmussen poll, Thurbert Baker doesn't even break double digits. In the Strategic Vision poll, he has a nice, healthy number. What do you think accounts for that difference?
Part of it may be methodology. Rasmussen, I'm pretty certain, are the folks that do the computer-generated calls. And I just, while I certainly respect their belief in their methodology, I'm not quite convinced that having a computer-generated voice or an automated polling methodology yields the same level of accuracy as having live callers talk to real voters does. So I think part of it may well derive from methodology, because you're right. Your first statement is absolutely right. There's really not been much action, and I don't really expect that there'll be much action between now and at least the first of next year, perhaps even a little bit later into next year. So while it's certainly fun for us political junkies to read all these polls that seem to come out weekly, I don't expect anything to really change in them unless some candidate goes up on the air anytime soon, and I doubt that anybody's going to do that.
Yes. Now, the risk of stealing Tim or Catherine, one of their questions on this, I'm going to ask one more before I pass it on. Roy Barnes has stayed consistently under 50%, but there is a good number of undecideds. Do you think it's just a foregone conclusion he'll get enough undecideds to break 50? Or is there something about the polling that shows that he's getting a hard time?
And the primary?
In the primaries.
I would think that he's going to have the resources to mount an effective campaign. Let's hope it's more effective than his 2002 campaign. but he'll have the resources to mount an effective campaign to bring over enough undecided voters that he should be able to break 50. I think it'll depend on the resources that Thurbert Baker brings to the table. If he's able to raise significant money and get on the air, then he could pull enough votes away from Barnes to keep Barnes under 50 and send that into a runoff.
Yes, well, I'm going to go ahead and pass it for the governor's questions to Tim, then Catherine.
Yes, ma'am. I want to jump over to the Republican side of things, if I can.
As long as you come back and you're a Democrat when the day is
over. Oh, yeah, I'll be a Democrat at the end of the show, I promise.
All right. David told me it's a Democratic show. I want to be sure.
It is, but we talk about Republicans here, and sometimes we even talk to Republicans here.
Yes, that's not a bad thing.
So anyway, all through the summer, we've noticed that John Oxendine has consistently maintained an 18-to-20-point lead over first Karen Handel and now Nathan Deal. And the first question I'd like to ask you is, does this race appear to be frozen? Or have you seen any movement at all? I have not seen any in this race.
I think it's frozen, and only because nobody has really been out there campaigning, reaching voters through TV primarily, but in a way that's going to move people away from undecided toward one of them. And I think Oxendine is in the lead right now because He's the longest standing statewide elected official running in that primary. He's been on the ballot a number of times. He chases a fair number of ambulances and gets his name and face in the news quite a bit. And so it's not surprising that he's out there with about a third of the vote. And I don't expect that to grow any until he gets on TV with a regular ad campaign.
Do you foresee anyone stepping forward? We had kept hearing about how well Karen Handel was doing at all these Republican events in her straw polling, but it's not translating at large out into Georgia. Why would you say that would be for her?
A name recognition. She's only been in statewide office for a relatively short period of time. What serves her well is that she comes from Fulton County. She comes from a significant chunk of voters in a Republican or in any primary, actually. But I just think that she just hasn't had a chance to establish herself statewide the way that someone like Oxendine has.
Okay, thank you, ma'am. Catherine?
Thank you very much for being with us on this rainy Sunday night in Atlanta.
As long as I'm inside, I'm okay.
Yeah. I just have some. You mentioned when we were talking about the Democratic governor's race that when we have this polling this early out, it's really more for us political junkies than. And I wonder sometimes how helpful these early polls are. And I just wondered if you had any comment on how important they are in the overall sort of election.
I think their greatest value is in influencing two key audiences. One is the media and the pundits and the folks like us that actually are paying attention to these races this far out, and the other is in influencing potential donors. Because if I were Oxendine or Barnes, I'd be running around all over the place saying, look, I've got a lead. I'm the front runner. You want to back the winner. You want to back the winner early. Get on board. So I think that their greatest value is in raising funds and in crowing to the world about the viability of the candidate.
Okay. That's kind of what I thought. I really don't have any more questions, but I'd love to hear I know David will have good questions. I'm kind of fascinated by the polls, but I honestly sometimes find them frustrating because it seems, you know, like we said, you know, nothing's happened. Why do we keep polling everything? But that's me.
Well, there are some folks that poll because that's what they do for a living, and they know that when they release findings, they get their name in the news. So it's a great marketing tool for
exactly.
I've got no problem with people polling. I just think that we're not going to see much change over the next few months in the governor's race.
Yeah, that's basically how. I mean, I don't have a problem with it. It just sometimes seems to be a distraction, perhaps. From some of the other things that are happening, for instance, the Atlanta municipal races that don't get as much attention because of the governor's polls and the attention to the 2010 governor's race.
Part of that is because up until recently there haven't been many independent polls conducted in the mayor's race, and I think we're seeing that starting to change now, and I think the pace of independent polling will pick up between now and November.
Yes.
David, what have you got?
Well, Catherine, there you go. You're going on to the next subject segue, and that's just fine. The Atlanta mayor's race was the next on the docket for us, and it seems like every poll you see is pretty much Mary Norwood first, Lisa Borders, fairly close second, then Kasim Reed, then Jesse Spikes, and there may be other candidates in the race, but those are kind of the four contenders, if you will. But it almost seems like some of the numbers are similar from poll to poll. Why do you think that race has set in to those numbers, even though things happen good for at least the leading three, and probably Jesse Spikes is the fourth candidate?
Well, actually, I would disagree a little bit with your premise. I don't think that race has set in. I think that there's been an interesting development over the last week or so in terms of the publicly released polling numbers, and I haven't seen anybody's private numbers, but just in terms of what I picked up in the media. The early polls, the polls early this year in the mayor's race in particular, the published polls, showed Mary Norwood with a comfortable lead, about a quarter, maybe 28, even 30% of the vote. And then significantly behind her were Lisa Borders, I think, in maybe the low teens, Kasim Reed, single digits, Jesse Spikes, single digits. Well, what the two most recent public polls have shown just over the last week or so is that Borders has moved up into a statistical dead heat with Norwood for the lead. So I think that there has been some movement in that race, and it's movement for Lisa Borders, who has moved up from low teens up to 28 or so points to virtually tie her with Mary Norwood. So I think that's one interesting development. The other is the fact that Kasim Reed is still in single digits, which to me is a little surprising. Again, nobody's been on the air yet, but Reed has sent out at least two mailers. At least I know that, or I've received a couple from him, and he's the only mayoral candidate that's trying to reach active voters or likely voters through the mail, and so he's starting to get a message out there, but it's not translating into votes for him.
Yes, and that was kind of one of the questions I had, is because he has had some real positive things happen for his campaign, but the polling numbers at this point don't show it. Well, go ahead, Catherine, since you're the City of Atlanta resident, I'm gonna let you have the next set of questions.
Well, I don't really have any questions specifically about the polling, but I am also surprised by Kasim's lack of higher polling numbers, because I've also gotten two mailers from him, and I think maybe one mailer from Mary Norwood, nothing from Lisa Borders. In addition, Kasim Reed's people have been in our neighborhood and walked down our long driveway twice, which is very unusual. People rarely walk down our long driveway to come to our front door and ask us what we're, what's on our minds.
What part of the city are you in?
We're in Southwest.
Yeah.
And the other interesting part of that is that Mary Norwood has a huge amount of support over here. We see signs in the yards all over. She's been very active over here, having coffees and, meet and greets for like over a year. But I am surprised by Senator Reed's sort of stagnant numbers, even though he, he's very visible and he comes out for the, he's been at the Fulton County Democrats meeting. He's been around. It's just I wonder, is it possible that they're just not reaching the right people on the polls?
No, because I think again what the polls have been measuring is similar to what they've been measuring in the governor's race, which is name recognition, and both Lisa Borders and Mary Norwood hold citywide office.
Mm-hmm.
They've both been on citywide ballot at least twice. Mary's, I think, in her she's in her in the end of her second term. So they've both been on the ballot twice. So their names are more familiar. They've through their in Lisa's case, I think 5 years. Mary's case, 8 years. Through their significant number of years on the council representing a citywide constituency, each would have had the opportunity to be out in the city and to be known by voters and to develop those kinds of connections with voters. And Senator Reed while he's certainly well-known in political circles, has represented either a specific House district or now a larger Senate district, but a legislative district that comprises only a part, not a small part, but not a huge part either, of the city. So he's well-known to voters who have been voting for him for a number of years for the legislature, but he's just not as well-known citywide.
I guess that does explain it. It surprises me every time I see those numbers.
Yeah, and that's where TV will be important, particularly for him over the fall, to really boost not only his name recognition but support for him among voters who just really don't know much about him.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Jim, questions on this?
Yes, I have one. Is there any possible way that a runoff can be avoided in this race?
Not with three strong vote getters in there. As long as qualifying closes on Friday and Lisa Borders, Mary Norwood, and Kasim Reed's names are all on that ballot for mayor, it seems unlikely that we avoid a runoff.
Okay, David.
If one of those three didn't qualify for some reason, then I think you could have a winner without a runoff. But I don't see any reason to believe that all three of them won't be qualifying.
Okay. Yes. Thank you.
Well, and that gets into talking about developments recently. Of course, there's the memo that came out, and I kind of have a two-part question there. One, I was looking at the AJC, and it had the racial composition of the city. Do you think the voting composition is going to reflect the racial composition of the city, or will it skew more heavily white, black, Hispanic, Asian, what have you?
The voting composition actually is not identical to the population composition. I think population is roughly 57% black and about 37% white, and the remainder other. And the registered voter population is a little bit smaller percentage black. It's 51% black and I think 36-37% white. And then a big chunk, about 12% of voters who identify themselves as an other category.
Okay. And then I guess the next question I had is, do you think that memo will affect polling numbers or in any way in the next next poll that comes out?
I don't know. I think part of it depends on the legs of that story. I don't know where it was distributed and what audiences have read the memo directly or received and read it directly. I know that there was a little bit of press coverage about it at the end of last week, and I think we'll see if it remains a story that the overall electorate is talking about over the next few days, or if it dies down, and it could have some impact. I think that the memo articulated a view that certainly some black voters in the city feel. Looking at some of the election returns from the last few years, I think that view represents a relatively small portion of black voters. But I don't know whether articulating it and having a memo out there talking about it changes anybody's minds or just might make some people feel more strongly about their views one way or the other on it. So
yeah.
a long way of saying I don't know what the impact of that will be on the polling data.
Okay. Well, and I guess moving out of Georgia, since we are a southern-based show, we picked one race outside of the state, and that was Florida, particularly the Senate race, where there's a possibly competitive Republican primary where you have a more moderate Republican and a very conservative Republican. And then, of course, that then leads into the general. But the primary seems to be the more fascinating race because it kind of is one of those battles for the soul of the party. Will the party continue to be more conservative, or will they actually accept moderate forces like the current governor, Charlie Crist? What's your take on that poll, or that race?
I think that's an interesting one because Crist is so popular that it would seem that he'd be the comfortable leader in that race, but the Republican base is just so stirred up right now and so angry that if that anger carries over into next year and those voters are really motivated to get out and send a quote unquote pure Republican to the Senate, then I think you've got the makings of an upset. I just think that the base is going to have to remain angry at the levels at which it's currently angry for a while, and I don't know that you can sustain that anger that long.
Yes.
Then again, look at how angry Democrats stayed at Bush. So that lasted about 8 years that we stayed angry at him. So, perhaps Republicans can sustain that anger as well.
Certainly. Tim, questions on the Florida race.
I've been noticing, of course, that Marco Rubio is obviously a genuine darling of the conservative blogosphere. And he, of course, along with other Florida conservatives, were screaming for Governor Crist to appoint the most conservative person that could be thought of to the U.S. Senate seat. Essentially, don't you think that Governor Crist was in a no-win situation when that seat suddenly opened up?
I'm not sure based on the appointment he made that it was quite as no-win as it seemed. it looks like he made a pretty shrewd appointment there. I don't know anything about this guy's politics of the appointee. But,
well, essentially, he appointed a longtime confidant, and he appointed a fella that was actually helping him search for a replacement. So I guess it was a safe appointment.
Well, that's kind of like Dick Cheney becoming the vice president.
Yeah,
I now call that a Dick Cheney.
Yeah,
he pulled a Dick Cheney.
So the Senate seat there was Cheneyed or Cheneyized.
and you also said, or alluded a moment ago to the fact that you think there's at least an opportunity for an upset there next year.
I would write it off. I think it's going to take a harmonic convergence for Rubio to do it, but I wouldn't write it off because I think that you're exactly right, or maybe it was David who said that there's a battle for the soul of the Republican Party. And the true believers are not happy with the direction that the national party's been going in for a while now, and they may put everything they can into getting Rubio elected.
Wow, wouldn't that be something, Catherine?
Well, I don't disagree with that. I think that that when you're talking about primaries, you're talking about devoted partisan voters. And there's always the chance that the national Republicans will have enough influence with those primary voters that they'll, knock Crist out of there. I think it's a long shot, but I don't think it's I don't think he's out of the woods. But
yeah,
I thought his appointment of this Lemieux guy was brilliant.
Yeah, it was pretty clever.
Oh, go ahead, Catherine.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, and then I guess final question on Florida, what are the chances that a Democrat could win that seat, even if Crist, the better, general election nominee, is the Republican nominee?
I think if Crist is the nominee, it's tougher for Democrats. If Rubio is the nominee, it depends on who the Democratic candidate is, but I think it certainly it looks more possible. But then you have to factor in the fact that it's a midterm election, and the trend generally is that the party in power loses seats, and it's tough in that atmosphere to pick up a seat, particularly in a state like Florida.
Yeah. Well, I guess now let's go ahead and move to the national level. And, of course, you have the Obama approval ratings and you have health care, and they simply see that they're tied together. We can kind of tackle these at once. And my first question will be, Obama's has gone down. I don't think he's gone down as much as some Republicans like to spin. But do you think that's more health care or more the Henry Gates situation or something totally different than either one of those?
I don't know. I don't think it's Henry Gates. I think it's mostly health care that's hurting him right now. I think that if he had to do it over again, he probably would have handled this issue differently and would have taken control of it earlier. I think he's let the issue control him, and I think he hasn't looked as strong or as forceful as he can. And I think more importantly, the American people don't fully understand exactly what his health care plan would do. And so in the absence of the White House being out there with an effective message about health care reform and why we need it and what the plan would do, his opponents have just had a field day making stuff up and repeating it, so much so that the Democrats have to spend time now telling Grandma she's not going to be put before a death panel and all this other stuff that they have to deal with. So I think that it's that. It's the deficit that people are concerned about. It's the economy, even though in general the economic signs are improving. There's still a lot of people out of work and just a lot of people getting kind of grumpy because they don't have jobs and businesses are seeing that people aren't spending money. And so I think there's kind of a grumpiness among the electorate right now, and they're just not as happy with Obama as they were when he first got elected, which he couldn't have sustained anyway because there was such euphoria around his election and his inauguration.
Yes, Catherine, questions on the national scene.
I'm going to let Tim go and see if I think of anything. Go ahead, Tim.
Yes, ma'am. Right now, President Obama's approval rating has only been exceeded at this point in his presidency, 7 months, in low approval ratings. He has the lowest in the modern era except for two presidents, Gerald Ford and Bill Clinton. So what I'm asking, does this slippage portend any, shall we say, bloodbath at the polls next year in the congressional elections?
Well, I think it's – I don't know if it portends it yet. I think if he doesn't take some steps to bring it back up, I think – yeah, I do think that there are some early warning signs that Democrats ought to be paying attention to, one being – Obama's slipping approval. The second being the public's general lack of support, or at least enthusiastic support for health care reform, and the fact that the Democrats in Congress still don't have approval ratings that Democrats in general would like to see. So I plus it's a midterm election, and traditionally the president's party loses seats in a midterm. So yeah, I think that there are some early warning signs that ought to have the White House and the DNC paying some attention. Now can they turn this around? Yes, but I think that they need to start to take some steps now to turn things around before the perception sets in among the chattering class that, oh, the Democrats are going to lose thousands of seats because X, Y, and Z.
Okay, and I just want to ask one more quick question, and I'll pass it on. A recent poll said that the great majority of the American people now, somewhere in the neighborhood of 67%, would like to see all members of Congress voted out of office. And yet we see... And I know you have in all the years that you've been in politics and looked at these elections, people always make an exception for their own congressman. Throw all the bums out except their own. Now, why do they do that?
Are you familiar with the word pork?
Yes.
let me explain pork to you, which I know you know pork because you live in the South, and that's all we eat here is pork products. But it's pork. You know, people hate Congress in general, but they love their own representative because their own representative comes back home on weekends and gets out and sees people and helps people and gets somebody's kid into college or gets somebody's Social Security check taken care of or brings home money for the local bridge or the road or the library or the whatever. And so people love their own member of Congress, but they hate the rest of Congress. Plus, we're at a point now throughout most of the country where congressional districts have been gerrymandered so much by both Democratic and Republican state legislatures that the lines are drawn in such a way that incumbents have to really mess up in order to lose, because they'd have to lose in a primary. They're not going to lose in a general because the districts are so clearly partisan, either Republican or Democratic.
Okay, I'll pass it back over to Catherine now. Catherine?
Everybody's asked all the questions that I would have thought of to ask.
Okay, Dave. Dr. Shapiro, you better be careful, because you start talking on this pork. One of our regular guests from time to time from the Atlanta Barbecue Club, who also is a big supporter of Bob Herndon, he's going to start calling in asking, like, sauce questions of you. All this pork talk. But seriously.
I'm happy to talk pork. I like pork.
I was going to ask you one more direct health care question. Now, a lot of times you see these polls, and they're worded one way. If they say, oh, government health care, it may go down. But then if we'll say universal health care for all, support goes up. What measure have you seen that seems like a fairly worded measure that could define what the support is for some type of, whether you call it governmental or universal health care?
That's a good question, because I'd have to, in all honesty, tell you I can't recall having seen specific wording that I would say, yeah, that really gets at it. But I think you're right on the larger point, which is that when people start talking about polls and or polling results around support for health care, you really do have to look carefully at the wording, because there clearly is some language that skews answers more than others.
Yes, and so that's why. But do you have any kind of, maybe not the wording, but do you have a sense of where that number might be for support for real health care for all?
No, I don't.
And I'm sure no one else does either. So it's not that you're. I just thought I'd give a stab at it. Well, Dr. Shapiro, I know I told you to stay, come on, maybe do a 15-minute interview. You've stayed much longer than that because you've been so engaging and interesting and informative.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed talking with you.
Yeah, you've created your own problem, but I want to thank you again for coming on. And if there's some more polls that come out, we may be calling you back up again.
Well, that sounds great. I'd be happy to talk with you again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Doc.
Take care.
Yes, well, that was good having somebody that can really cut through these numbers. And also, given the fact that we had a Atlanta City and Georgia State residents to talk about the State of Georgia polls and the Atlanta City polls. Well, we had talked about it in the polling aspect of it, but I think we need to talk about it in the the meat of the situation. There was a polling memo that came out, or I'm sorry, a memo that came out from the Black Leadership, was it Council? Did Catherine or Tim correct me if I've got the last name wrong?
I can't remember what they're called, but
Black Leadership Forum.
Yeah.
Forum.
Yeah.
We'll give them Forum and we'll give them Black. I don't know that many people right now are giving them leadership, including the current African American mayor, the African American City Council president, and the African American State Senator who's running for mayor. I know all three of those African Americans. They dismissed this group, what they had to say. Catherine, since you're an Atlanta City resident, what was your first reaction to this memo?
I thought it was outrageous. I was really troubled by it. I saw it early in the week. Someone forwarded it to me or something. I don't remember. I was surprised that Lisa Borders wasn't more forceful in her dismissal of when Bernita Smith asked her about it. She said she didn't agree with it, she didn't distance herself from that, from the support. So I was a little troubled by that. I thought that Senator Reid and Mary Norwood's response were very good. This isn't helpful. This conversation isn't helpful. But I just am troubled by the idea that we would. This is where we're at in 2009, almost 2010.
Yeah.
And I think that Senator Reid should be troubled by it because, you know, it's basically asking him to step aside and make room for Lisa when he obviously feels like he has something to offer for leadership in the city of Atlanta. And he's been, you know, a good, solid state senator for his third term? So I'm troubled by it.
Catherine, can I jump in with a question for you? Has anyone down there said, you know, this bunch doesn't speak for the majority of people in Atlanta, so, you know, let's choose to ignore these people? Has anyone gone along those lines?
Well, that's basic. I don't know that Senator Reid and Mary Norwood actually said ignore it, but they did say in their statements, and all that stuff is posted at Blog for Democracy, they did say, you know, that they didn't agree with it. But to be fair, the people who are allegedly in this Black Leadership Forum are some of the, you know, long-standing important African American leaders in the city. So it's hard to say they're, you know, a bunch of crazy people because they're, you know, they have a lot of influence.
My next question is, did they all sign off on this particular memo, or was this the action of only one or two people?
That is the question that we don't know the answer to. I do not know the answer to that question. I think there's some question about that.
Okay.
Well, the thing I think is, you know, we know this has gone around all across the nation where there's two white candidates and a Black candidate. And the Black candidate may have a chance to win. And there's certain members of the white community that say, hey, we need to do something to make sure that Black candidate doesn't win. And I think it happened much more in the past than it would happen now. But I'm sure some places this may happen again now. And I'm sure these guys in the Black Leadership Forum would completely be turned off by that type of action, rightfully so. But don't they see that this is the exact same thing in reverse, if you will? I mean, it's just, I don't know that they get it. I mean, I guess it's just more important holding on to this piece in their mind, for whatever it may be, because what's funny is I'm sure if you actually went issue by issue, there's some issues that they're going to agree with all the candidates a little more than the others, since there's not as big an ideological difference in this race. I just don't see that these folks see the bigger picture, if you will.
Well, I don't know if you saw the response. There was a response written to that memo from another, I can't remember who it was, another African-American leader in Atlanta, who said that there's no evidence. I mean, I shouldn't quote it because I can't remember exactly what he said, but basically saying that, you know, African-Americans haven't always fared well under African-American leadership either. You know, especially, I think that it really comes down to economics usually more than race in almost any urban situation particularly. But, you know, the public housing has been pretty much eliminated by our current African-American mayor, which has been predominantly utilized by African-Americans in Atlanta. And there's other things that have hurt the African, especially the less wealthy African Americans in Atlanta. So it's kind of a fake argument that African Americans always are going to fare better under an African American leader. So I think that. Senator Reid and Mary Norwood and I think Lisa Borders to a lesser extent highlighted that in their remarks as well. So,
well, I mean, we could just talk about this thing for the whole rest of the show.
We could.
One thing I'd point out is when Maynard Jackson became mayor, because they referenced that a lot. You know, the city of Atlanta then had a Black leader, but Clayton County, DeKalb County, and the Fulton County government were essentially all white. Now today, let's say, you know, there would be a white mayor. You still have then DeKalb County, Clayton County, and the head, John Eaves, of the Fulton County Commission, all African Americans. So, I mean, it's, you've diversified the larger metro population. Even other counties, I think Douglas may actually have, I know they have African American commissioners. I don't know if the commission chair is, but I mean, all these counties are diversifying, and so maybe that's just the nature of things. The suburbs are going to be more diverse now, and then but then the city is going to be so diverse, but then that diversity may not always be completely racial one way. It may be that you have white mayors at times and maybe a mayor of some other race or ethnicity that we don't predict, given that, you know, some people running for city council. But I guess I do want to keep it a southern show and move on to some other states. In Louisiana, General Henry has made moves that he wants to look at running for Senate in the Republican primary against David Bitter. There's only one thing I didn't like about that, the fact that he was looking at running as a Republican. I would have loved to see him run for some office as a Democrat, since he seemed to be a kind of a can-do guy. Tim, what was your thought on this?
Well, I would say all of a sudden Senator Bitter doesn't look as stable as he did. I mean, we're talking about the guy, if people don't remember, General Honoré, who was recognized by many people as the hero of Katrina, the guy who came in and finally got people fed and got basic services out to everybody and saved a bunch of lives. So he's going to be well thought of should he enter this race. Secondly, even if Bitter does have a large war chest, he's got a lot of baggage, and he's going to get beat over the head. Should he survive that, then he faces Congressman Millicone. And, you know, it's well known in Louisiana that Cajuns vote for Cajuns.
Now we're going backward to our last topic.
No. It is well known that that just happens down there. You can look at the history of elections in Louisiana and see that happen. They represent a sizable block of votes, plus the natural Democratic constituents that would vote for Millicone. I think we might can get Bitter, is what I'm saying.
Well, I definitely think we should be able to get Bitter. I think getting Bitter in the general is going to be easier than getting that seat from General Henry. And the interesting thing, I think, is the fact that the Republicans may be very excited to replace him and as their party standard bearer for two reasons. One, Bitter's as sleazy as can be, but also he diversifies their party.
We've talked about this before, David. I don't like skunks and crooks. And if General Honoré can take him out, even if it means General Honoré wins the general election, well, Godspeed to that man, because David Bitter does not belong in the hallowed halls of the U.S. Congress.
Oh, certainly.
Let me just say that, you know, Republican or Democrat, I think that the U.S., the people, the citizens of the country would be served by General Honoré as a senator.
Yeah.
I really do. I mean, I have a lot of respect for that guy, and I think
much
that
better
his,
than Bitter.
His mission, his whole—I don't know if you've read about what he's devoting his time to right now. This whole idea of national preparedness, I think, is really important, and I think that if that's a topic, a voice that would be well served in our in the U.S. Senate. And you know, fortunately, I don't live in Louisiana, so I wouldn't have to make that decision, but. He looks, and I don't know that he's really going to run. I mean, there's not, he hasn't really said he's going to, but I think this, I think that what he's talking about is really important, and if he can get some ink and some voice on the, and some noise on the airwaves about it, I think it's really good.
Well, I'm going to give him some free advice in case he teams in the Kudzu Vine. Just wait till next year, or 2011. Do more good work at the state level, because, of course, you want to be an executive. You don't want to be in the legislative branch. Run as a Democrat against Bobby Jindal.
No, he can't beat him.
Run as an independent, if you must, against Bobby Jindal.
He can't beat him.
Oh, I don't know. I think he could
beat Governor Jindal.
Well, Tim, we can always hope if he's as big a hero. I mean,
we can hope, but I got to, you know, I got to give my realistic assessment. I don't. I believe if there's an unbeatable statewide candidate in Louisiana right now, it's got to be Governor Jindal.
Now, our Mitch Landrieu.
And it pains me to say it.
Yeah, Mitch Landrieu is pretty popular statewide because of some of the stuff he did, Katrina. He was seen as much more of a leader than some others. Well, let's go ahead and talk about a guy that would be very beatable right now, and that's Mark Sanford. This guy, it seems like every week, every other week, this guy just gives a little something. This time, Mark Sanford didn't directly give us anything, but 56 Republicans in the South Carolina State House did. They met, and not a single representative voiced support for Mark Sanford, and they're looking to move towards impeachment. Catherine, what do you think of this?
How many times have I said it? It's the gift that keeps on giving.
Well, he can just to hold that title, and he's giving it up to Mark Sanford.
He cannot cut a break, that guy. I mean, no matter what happens, every week it's something else for him. I think he should just quit. I think it's how effective can he seriously be at this point as the governor, really? I mean, he's the laughingstock of the country, let alone his own home state. And that and this kind of lack of support from his own party is just embarrassing. He should just quit.
Yeah, one thing we talked about last week with the Vogue interview, we can talk about this. This guy was married to a lady that poses with her legs showing in Vogue, and he wasn't even happy with her. I mean, now you can't even get behind him on that score anymore, that he doesn't have good taste, good sense, if you will. Tim, what's your thoughts?
Well, this weekend retreat coupled with the fact that the lieutenant governor has just basically publicly asked him to resign, I want to throw something out there for your consideration, David. You know that South Carolina has probably one of the strongest state Republican organizations in the nation. Is this guy in such denial that he is willing to risk destroying the Republican Party of South Carolina?
Does he really care? I mean, that's the question. I don't know that he cares. He's maybe very selfish. And if he's self-motivated, although I don't see any upside for him, I mean, whatever, you know, his legacy's going to be, it seems like he's going to have to point to the first 6 years of his term legislatively anyway. I don't know what he's going to pass in the next year and a half to change that around.
No, his legacy now in the history books will always involve the purchase of a plane ticket to Argentina. That's the first thing that's going to be said about
it. The spin he's going to create would be that, you know, whatever he did early, I don't think there's anything he can pass to change that. I agree, it's going to be the jokes. The laughing stock. Catherine,
can't he see that's not working?
You think he'd have to.
He would have to. And, I don't know that this would destroy the Republican Party. I think that if – it depends on what happens. If he does resign, then the party says, oh, see, we put a lot of pressure on him and we made him resign.
Right.
If they impeach him, then they say, oh, well, we have so much power that we were able to impeach him. So I don't know that it necessarily hurts the party. I think it's really all about Sanford at this point. You know, he's damaged goods at this point. There's there's no redemption politically, as far as I can
see. Right.
And this is how the South Carolina Republicans should spin it. They impeach him, they should say, look, you know, a lot of us, you know, they probably signed some resolution back in 98, the ones that were there. You know, we supported impeaching Clinton, but we're not being partisan. We're being fair. This guy did much the same thing, cheated on his wife, and we were consistent. And they can spin it that way, and that'll like
yeah, absolutely.
So I don't think it'll destroy the party necessarily, particularly in this this environment. If it were a more national environment that wasn't having the Republicans so fired up, because I really don't think the average voter's changed that much opinion in the past, say, 10 months since the November election. I just think it's who's more galvanized. I think Republicans are far more at this moment in time.
Well, let's go ahead and move to another topic. In Kentucky, one we didn't get to talk about as much as we'd like to have, Jim Bunning has decided not to run for office. I think we've mentioned that before. But then the first poll came out, and Trey Grayson, the Secretary of State, who was going to run against Jim Bunning anyway, has taken the lead over both the Lieutenant Governor and the Attorney General, both Democrats. But that poll is very tight, just about a five-point divide, with the Lieutenant Governor slightly ahead. Tim, what do you make of this Kentucky scene?
Well, it's very simple what happened, and Bunning himself admitted it, that the money spigot was turned off, and it was turned off under the direction of Senators Cornyn and McConnell. And the reason they did it was to try to save this seat, and they might have just done that. This is the best thing that could have happened, because I'm willing to guarantee you that on election night next year, the first senator that would have gone down would have been Jim Bunning.
Oh, yes. That was a Republican that was in trouble, a positive possible Democratic
yep.
pickup in a state which Republicans shouldn't have lost in the environment the way it looks like it's shaping up. Kathy,
right.
your thoughts on Kentucky?
I think you've said it. You know, I think it's the best thing for the Republicans to get him out of there. And
yeah,
they managed to do it. I mean, it's not like it was an accident. So.
Yes, and it'll be interesting to see, because Kentucky's such a strange state in that inside the state, when the politics kind of stops at the Kentucky border, Democrats are doing great.
Yeah, that's
but then when
their Democratic Party is strong.
Nationally,
yeah.
when it comes time to. Look at presidential races and whatnot, they just won't have anything to do with Democrats. And it's not just Senator Obama. John Kerry didn't do that well. Al Gore didn't make any real inroads. It's one of those states where, you know, it's definitely the national party's the other party in Kentucky. Now, will this become more of a national race since it is a federal office? Or can these two seemingly popular politicians, Conway and Manganiello, can one of them break out of that? I actually kind of like the underdog of the two, Jack Conway, the younger attorney general. I think he may have a better shot. Any thoughts on that real quick?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think he has a better shot. I think he's got a lot of support from within the party.
Well,
quietly.
I tell you what else we're going to see too, guys. Don't you think we're going to see a close race there on election night?
Oh, yes. It's going to be one to watch.
Yeah.
Fundraising. What the polls say, what ads come out, when the debates come on C-SPAN, you can watch it from different states. That'll be an interesting one to watch. The blogosphere
yep.
will be burning up. Well, I tell you what, guys, we didn't get to every topic, and I don't even want to, in the last minute and a half, I don't even want to try to get into Congress Georgia 9 or Congress Georgia 4, because I don't think we can do it justice, but I think what we've learned there will keep till next week. So let's go ahead and we'll say goodbye, but then we're going to leave everybody with a humor piece on Glenn Beck and his problems from John Brenneman of the Boston Herald. So good night to everybody from the Kudzu Vine. Tim, Catherine.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good evening. I'm Humor Gazette news anchorman Reed Page, and this is the 13 o'clock news. Fox hate pundit Glenn Beck has been hemorrhaging advertisers ever since he called President Obama a racist with a, quote, deep-seated hatred of white people. But Fox News is reporting that new advertisers are now signing on. They include Assault Weapons R Us, Bughouse Mental Hospitals, and the American Nazi Party. Big dollar clients CVS and Lawyers.com have been replaced by NRA and DomesticTerrorist.com. Fox said it stands by Beck's right to make a bigoted, traitorous ass out of himself and to use hateful propaganda to poison viewers against America's president as long as that tainted money keeps rolling in. Bleach giant Clorox has washed its hands of Beck's verbal filth, only to be replaced by mudslinging ad agency the Willie Horton Group. Pulling ads are Radio Shack, UPS, and Walmart. Replacing them are Militia Shack, Preparation H, and KKK Mart. A Fox spokesman assured viewers that the controversy will not affect Beck's commitment to inflammatory programming aimed at inciting disgruntled rubes to overthrow Obama with pitchforks, chainsaws, and guns. For Humor Gazette News, I'm Anchorman Reed Page.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic...